run through them very quickly. First, time is non-existent for God in himself and thus totally meaningless for him. God has no conception of duration or sequence and thus no conception of events as past, as presently in progress, or as future. That is, there's no past, present, and future with God. Everything is always now for God, and there is no now before this now or now after this now. See, in other words, you can't then, I mean, some people are very clever, they say, everything is now for God, but there is a before now and an after now. But this view rejects that, okay? This view rejects that. In this view, God has often been described as existing above time, in a timeless necessity of existence, in an eternal present, above all limitations of time. All those phrases are used to describe this particular viewpoint. Mr. Crow. Second view. Time is either non-existent or existent for God in himself, but its sequence and duration in the created universe are existent and are subject to God's will. In this view, God can make time's arrow go forward or backward and can stretch a day to endure for 1,000 years or reduce 1,000 years to the duration of one day. In this view, God could arrange it that sunlight, which takes 8 1/3 minutes to reach our eyes, could show us not what the sun looked like 8 1/3 minutes ago, but what it will look like 8 1/3 minutes from now. God could make time's arrow go either way. But this view says that time is either non-existent or existent for God in himself. However, the important thing is that the sequence and duration are subject to God's will. Now, that's the central idea in this view. God can make time do whatever he wants to, subject to his will. See, it doesn't really say whether time is existent or non-existent for God in himself. That doesn't get into that question. The third view. Time is either non-existent or existent for God in himself. But although time is existent in the created universe in time in terms of discernible sequence, that is, time's arrow always points in one direction, and is thus meaningful to God in those terms, yet its duration is subject to God's will. He can stretch days or reduce millennia at will. In other words, time always goes one direction, but God can telescope it or stretch it at will. So this does say there is a direction to time, but God can make it do what he wants, not make it go backward or run it backwards or forwards, no, but he can stretch it or reduce it. In this view, time is meaningful to God in terms of sequence and as a functional determination of his will in terms of duration. Mr. Platt? All right, the fourth view. Time is existent for God in himself. Now, this is the first view that says that time has an existence for God in himself. That is, the other views, 2 and 3, said maybe, you know, maybe not. Well, we're not going to get into that. Number 1 says it's non-existent. But now this one says it is existent. But the difference between one day and 1,000 years compared with eternity is so minuscule that, relatively speaking, there is no significant difference between them for God. Comparatively speaking, between one day and 1,000 years compared with eternity, difference is minuscule. Okay? Fifth view. Time is existent for God in himself, but God's long-suffering and patience towards sinful men are so great that whether he waits one day or 1,000 years, it is all the same to him. His patience will endure, at least during the present dispensation of grace, but it will not last forever, since the day of the Lord will come as does a thief at an appointed time. The sixth year. Time has existence for God in himself, but time's divisions are measured differently in heaven. One day in heaven, that is, with the Lord, is equal to 1,000 years here on earth, and 1,000 years on earth are equal to one day in heaven. Just as, for example, a year on the planet Pluto is equivalent to 247.7 years on earth, and it could be said one year on Pluto is as 247.7 years on earth. That's interpretation, you understand, of 2 Peter 3:8. Mr. Elmer, time is existent for God in himself, but this has reference to the outworking of God's purposes in the created universe. The Lord, by supernatural power, can accomplish in one day, in one earth day, what would by natural process take 1,000 years to accomplish. As far as his supernatural power is concerned, 1,000 years of natural process can be accomplished in one day. This interpretation would emphasize the scriptural truth that God is not limited to working through natural processes, and can, by supernatural power, bring all of human history to its completion in a very short time, and thus bring all of his promises to fulfillment in the very face of mockers and scoffers. Mr. Brown.
What to do with, it's a, simply a stress upon God's long-suffering toward sinful men, whereas number 7 has a stress upon God's work, outworking of purposes in the created universe. You're talking about natural process in number 7. That is, it's a stress. The question of emphasis, that's all. And what interpreting basically 2 Peter 3:8. That's really what they're getting at. Although we have proposed various interpretations of 2 Peter 3:8, we're still left with the question, is there time with God? And the question, what is eternity? When we ask the question, is there time with God? We've got to get down to a basic conception of time. And we must make clear what we're not talking about. That's first, got to clear the deck. First, calendar time. This raises the question, which calendar? The Julian calendar, authorized by Julius Caesar in 46 BC, measured time until AD 1582. It assumed that the true year was 365 and a quarter days long. In 730, the Venerable Bede, an Anglo-Saxon monk, announced that the Julian year was 11 minutes 14 seconds too long. This amounted to the gain of one full day every 128 years. Nothing was done about it. However, by 1582, the error was estimated to have amounted to 10 days. Pope Gregory XIII decreed that the day following October 4, 1582, should be called October 15th instead of October 5th. That's one, it's wonderful to have that kind of power. Yeah, well, they got lost. The Gregorian calendar, authorized by Pope Gregory XIII, was immediately adopted in most Roman Catholic countries. Many Protestant countries did not accept it until the 18th century. British government adopted this calendar in 1752 and decreed that the day following September 2nd, 1752, should be called September 14th instead of September 3rd, thus dropping 11 days. All dates before September 2nd, 1752 were called Old Style. Thus George Washington was born February 11th, 1732, Old Style, and after 1752, his birthday fell on February 22nd.
Like
a difference in our calendar between old style and new style. When you get back to dates around that time, you have to watch it, because there you can be off by a number of certain days. The Gregorian calendar, which made every fourth year a leap year and three of every four centesimal years common years, that is, every hundredth year, every year divisible by 100, okay, is a centesimal year. So 1700, 1800, 1900, 2000, they're centesimal years. Now, three of every four centesimal years were made common years. See, every fourth year is a leap year, but three of every four centesimal years are common years. And this was adopted by Japan in 1873, by China in 1912, Greece in 1924, and by Turkey in 1927. There's a wide variety in the way the calendars have worked out. We're not talking about calendar time, first of all, when we ask, is there time with God? And that'd be curious, dropping out 11 days out of God's calendar. Secondly, Mr. Warner, what conception of time about which we're not talking when we ask, is there time with God, is sidereal or solar earth time? Sidereal Earth time is the revolution period of the Earth about the Sun from a given star back to the same star again. That is, not to the same location of the star, but the way you view the star. Solar Earth time is the revolution period of the Earth about the Sun from vernal equinox to vernal equinox, the point where the Sun crosses the equator from south to north. And there are the times given. 365 days, 6 hours, 9 minutes, 9 and a half seconds for sidereal time. 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, 46 seconds for solar time. All right, we're not talking about that concept of time, all right? Physics time concept. Measured duration. Duration, according to a physical measuring device, is a physics definition. For example, a physical definition of a second of time was adopted in 1964 in terms of the burst of atomic radiation emitted by cesium, which has a known frequency. One atomic second is equal to 9,192,631,770 cycles of the radiation of cesium. This was made a part of the International System of Units in 1967.
I believe there's been another correction since that particular time, and we're operating now on an international system of time which is very, 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 very accurate. Very accurate. But we're not talking about physics time concept. All right? We're not talking about time in terms of a physical measuring device, a measurement of some physical process. Fourthly, we're not talking about time as development or decomposition. That is, even in a non-physical sense. This would not apply to God in any physical sense, of course. But if God is immutable, and if this implies the absence of development or of decomposition, this concept would not apply to God even in the non-physical sense. However, if none of... Because, you see, you could say, under number four, you could say, but if you admit to any kind of development, as in the process theology, or you admit to any kind of decomposition, as William Hamilton suggested in The Death of God View, taking his point of departure from the work of Nietzsche in The Madman, then, of course, even if you don't measure time by anything physical, you still have a conception of time which this does not imply or mean. However, if none of these four conceptions of time is intended when we talk of whether or not there is time with God, then what conception of time is left? To this we must reply, if speaking of time as a unidirectional continuum of experience, including before and after relationships in sequential order. To make a footnote here on the word continuum, although that is a familiar word to some of you, it is not to others. I might simply suggest this, that a continuum, if you want to make a footnote, there's space at the bottom of the page here. A continuum is something which is marked by an absolute, uninterrupted extension in space, time, or sequence. A continuum is something which is marked by an absolute, uninterrupted extension. We can talk about continuums or continua, however you want to say it, in various contexts. The word is used frequently in differing contexts. Now, there's space here, that's blank space there, okay. There's space here for what I'd like to insert. Three ideas, basically. We'll put an arrow with the line. Sequential order, in which you not only have a unidirection, that is a directional arrow, but a sequence, in which A comes before B and B comes after A. A unidirectional continuum of experience, including before and after relationships in sequential order. This continuum refers to experience, and it refers to God's experience. Being asked is there time in this sense, the sense of this definition, with God? Does God experience before and after relationships not simply outside of himself, as in the created universe, but within his own experience of himself, that is, in his self-experience?
There are two grand and crucial scriptural events which help us to decide this question whether or not there's time with God. And the first is that of original creation. His word, God brought the created universe into being. Before the created universe began to exist, there was only God, nothing else. After the created universe began to exist, there was the creator and the creature, the true God and his handiwork. That is, what we have here in the original created fire, we have an exercise of efficiency on the part of God. God is exercising efficiency to call into being that which was not, namely the created universe. Now, I'm not talking about further concepts of immediate creation or mediate creation in the development of various aspects of the universe. I'm talking about the initial exercise of efficiency to bring into being the initial conditions for the universe as we know it. So you can talk about various other distinctions in God's creative activity, when we come to creation, we'll talk about creation ex nihilo and immediate creation and mediate creation. Mr. Fox coming to full force with Augustine, and then the medieval theologians picked it right up. Again, I don't know all the ins and outs of why they did it. That's interesting. It seems to make God more exalted to say that he is above all limitations of time. Well, if what you do is you rule out all these other concepts of time, you don't have to limit God. You see? Of course, some people would feel that even sequence is a limitation. Okay. Of course, that can be turned around. And you have to be careful how you work with that. Because we experientially know what sin is and God doesn't. Experientially, as far as knowledge of personal involvement, except, of course, by way of negation, you can say that. But you cannot say in terms of positive involvement. Yes, Mr. Upton.
Yeah, you mentioned last time this whole problem of God and time. A lot of things that crept into our thinking which aren't necessarily good. And it's interesting in reading Hodge how many times he'll say such and such school has this misunderstanding and this has to do with their view of God and time. Over and over again.
I've been amazed to see how often the question of God and time enters into various theological contexts. But we mentioned the last time that we were together that there were two rather important scriptural events which help us to decide whether or not there is time with God. And the first is original creation, and the second is that of the incarnation of the Son of God. And here, I'd like to draw the other diagram on the board so that we can get this out in front of us. This one is a little more complicated than the first one. It forces us, this second event, to speak of a before and an after. A before the incarnation and an after the incarnation. And we speak of that not simply in the time-space dimensions or intersection of dimensions. We're talking about the self-experience of the second person of the Godhead. We're talking about his experience. There was a time when he was not yet incarnate. And there was a time when he was incarnate. Whatever words you use, a moment, a time, there's some kind of terminology that must be employed to capture the truth in this particular event. Before the incarnation, the Lord Jesus Christ was God and only God. After the incarnation, he was the God-man. There was a time when he did not have a human nature. There was a moment in his own experience when he became the God-man, with all the implications of that word, became. There is a proper sense here of becoming. Now, of course, we have to look at it further in terms of what are the implications in regard to change. Did this mean that the second person of the Godhead was not immutable? That's an interesting question. And we'll certainly look at that one further. Mr. Beaver, it continues right on. Sometimes we tend to think of the incarnation as ending with the resurrection or with the ascension. Doesn't end. And it's difficult to show this in a diagram because you tend to become spatial. Now, that's what we want to do. Oh, I see. Mr. Reinhardt. Before and after incarnation. So that, as Mr. Upton pointed out, you can't really make it that the Son absents himself from the Trinity at this particular point, as far as the next doctrine at which we're going to look, the doctrine of omnipresence. The Son doesn't absent himself, so that you no longer have a Son here, the Son is down here. No thought of that at all. So it is an event merely to show the before and after sequence in relationship. That is the definition of time which we offer. A unidirectional continuum of experience including before and after relationships in sequential order. There's no idea of measured duration measured by physical changes or movement. There's no concept of that at all in here. All right? A question, Mr. Basil. Well, what I'm suggesting, I think, in regard to this event is that the incarnation is unique and that if one posits Christophanies in the Old Testament, it's not the same thing as the incarnation. That is an actual becoming flesh. All right. Page 12. In this sense of time, we're forced to the conclusion that there is time with God. We can properly speak of God before and after he created the universe, and of the Son of God before and after he became incarnate. Notice I didn't say after he ceased being incarnate, I said after he became incarnate. And these events took place not simply in the space-time history of the created universe, they're genuine events in God's self-experience. There's one scripture which disturbed or comforted many Christians in connection with the question of God and time. Revelation 10:6. Would someone who has the authorized version turn to Revelation 10, please, and someone loudly read verses 1 through 6. Mr. Brown? Thank you.
Okay. Revelation 10:1-6. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. And his face was as were the sun, and his feet as doors of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he sat his right foot upon the sea, and his left foot on the earth, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Seal up those things which were the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven, and the things that therein are, and the earth, and the things that therein are, and the sea, and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer.
Thank you. The word is chronos. The word is chronos. There's a place here, a little dash, a little opening for the word in the notes. Now, commentators suggest on one part that this means time in the absolute sense, that time itself will cease. It will stop. It will come to an end. No longer exists. Others take the assertion to mean that with respect to the consummation of this age, there shall be no further delay. There shall be no more delay. The end has finally come. Curiously, those who take Revelation 10:6 to mean that time itself will cease offer nothing more as evidence for their view than 2 Peter 3:8. Remember what 2 Peter 3:8 said? Okay. 1,000 years is a day. Day is 1,000 years. Those who take it to mean that there will be no further delay in bringing the mystery of this age to its consummation point out that verses 6 and 7 go together, that verse 7 states that the time which shall be no longer is connected with the trumpet of the seventh angel, which shall announce the completion of the mystery of God, that in Revelation 11 and verse 15, the seventh angel sounds his trumpet, and the announcement is made that the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And that after the pouring out of the seven vials or bowls of the wrath of God, Christ himself returns to rule and to reign for 1,000 years. Of course, we understand the eschatological distinctions in regard to Revelation 20. Among those who take the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven vials as referring to real events described by literal language, for the most part, I do not know of any New Testament scholar or theologian that does not place these three groups of seven, however they structure them, as taking place before Christ's return and before the 1,000-year millennium. Now, of course, you can rule out the last part amongst amillennialists and postmillennialists, but as far as the first part, they all take them as taking place before Christ's return. Therefore, if after the accomplishment of the angel's oath that there shall be time no longer, there is a period of 1,000 years, of course, that's again in a millennium, a premillennial structure, the oath cannot mean that there shall no longer be time in the absolute sense. Of course, you could take other things which succeed that, which appear to be sequentially related, before and after in sequence. And therefore, I would propose that there is time with God, that there is succession in God's self-experience, that there was a before creation and an after creation in God's self-experience, that the designations B.C. and A.D., are at least as meaningful to the Son of God as they are to me, that God is dynamic and not static, that is active and not purely passive, that God's exercise of will and God's actions succeed one another in his self-experience, that there is past, present, and future with God, that although God knows the end from the beginning, he has not yet experienced the end. Some people like to think in this philosophical conception of God's timelessness, again, for which there is no scriptural evidence, they like to think of God's timelessness as a circle and things simply going round and round and round and round and round. But of course, it really isn't that way, even in their conception. They're, I think, thinking of round and round like this. I think that's what they're really thinking of, round and round in that fashion, because they don't really mean that if you start here, go all the way around, you come back to the same events, and the same events occur over and over. They don't mean that. They mean more of the cyclical type of thing, but even that has problems as far as the conception of timelessness is concerned. Because in a cyclical conception, you do, that is, if you move in one direction, unidirectional, you do move in such a way that you come over here, you don't come back to here. As far as God viewing the events of history, you probably want to take this position more than this.
Well, yeah.
Unless everything starts over again. Yeah. And then, okay. And then, longitude. You know, I have problems with that also in terms of these events in which God is personally involved. Now, if you take more of a deistic conception, in which God sort of stands off and views things as they occur, that I could see as different. But when God, for instance, makes a prediction and then later on exercises energy, that is, it puts forth energy to bring about a miraculous fulfillment of that prediction, then I have problems seeing the two as simultaneous. in God's own self-experience. Besides these events, which we've noted. Right, may I add something to that? That the experience isn't going to change God's cognitive knowledge either. In other words, if God knows the end from the beginning, but he hasn't yet experienced the end, the experience when he gets to the end isn't going to be any different from the knowing. It's going to be exactly the same as the knowing. That's the difference between cognitive and experiential knowledge. Okay, Mr. Basil, did I miss you? Do you have your hand up?
Speaking of God's continuum of existence. And we're speaking sort of a metaphorical way of the beginning and the end.
Let's say, in relation to the created universe and God's relationships to it. Okay. Now, technically, I would define eternity on page 13 as an infinite, unbounded, unidirectional continuum of experience, including before and after relationships in sequential order. I would further propose that God alone is eternal. The physical universe, angels, Satan, demons, and men are not eternal. Thus, I would distinguish between God's existence and experience, which are eternal, that is, unbounded by beginning or ending time, and man's existence and experience, which are temporal and unending. God is eternal, man is temporal, and his existence and experience are unending. And thus, I would represent God's infinity. I would represent God's infinity in this fashion. And the zero there represents the moment that we came into being. We are temporal and unending. I would prefer to distinguish between God, who is eternal, and man, who is unending. Yeah, another everlasting could be another way of saying it. Although that could get sticky, but I really don't know enough about the physics of time. That is, the measured duration itself, all frames of reference. For time in different universes of discourse. See, if you use time in the physics sense, you've got to identify the way in which you're using it. Otherwise, you can be talking about time with God, which I'm advocating, that there is time with God. And you can be talking about measured duration in the physics sense and be using the word in quite different ways. And then, when you begin to try to make correlations, as Mr. Pickard raised the question, you can get into serious problems. I don't know just whether I'm equipped to handle that question. Time limitations. I'm going to ask you that if you have specific questions that you would like to develop further, that you would work out some arrangement so that we could deal with them on a one-on-one basis so that I may proceed with the next area. I am getting behind, and that's not your fault. I was ill, but I am getting behind time-wise as well. And we've got so much to cover that I just don't know how we're going to get through it all. However, I'd be happy to either talk with you before or after class if there's time. And or else, if you want to make an appointment, and we could see each other at lunch or sometime in which I'm here. Today, however, I'd like to proceed into the area of God's omnipresence and really finish that area. This is an enormous problem, the omnipresence of God. Again, like the concept of time, it seems to bear on so many doctrinal areas. And I suspect that you would, if you sat down and thought about it a little bit, think that it's probably quite proper that it should. Time and space being two rather important coordinates to the kind of universe to which we're used. Now, God's omnipresence is the infinity of God in relation to space. It's also spoken of as ubiquity. God's ubiquity, which is sometimes confused with iniquity. Ubiquity. It simply means that God is everywhere. He's ubiquitous. His omnipresence may be defined as the infinitude of his being viewed in relation to all of his creatures, whether rational beings, non-rational living creatures, or non-living material things. This attribute states that God is in all places equally present with all his creatures. His ubiquity may be defined as the presence of God being everywhere at the same time. Sometimes God's immensity is spoken of in connection with his attribute. This does not mean that he is enormously large, but it stresses the idea that God's essence fills all of space. God is in all of his attributes completely present in every location in space. Here is a distinction which Hodge makes and which we've repeated. Physical bodies are in space circumscriptively. Finite spirits are in space definitively. And God is in space repletively. Those are simply terms. Now, at the top of page 14, here's a space for a little diagram. And we'll just... The knowledge arrows go one way because the knowledge comes to God. But in a sense, he is elsewhere as to his knowledge. He knows what's going on in earth. He knows everything that's going on. And he exerts power from a distance, from afar. Now, you could replace the word earth with the word the world or the universe. By universe, between there, the physical universe. Or the created universe, to be more specific. For this biblical doctrine of the omnipresence of God is Psalm 139. And if you would turn with me to it, we'll look at it briefly. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou dost understand my thought from afar. Somebody says, aha, see, there's the deistic view. See, thou dost understand my thought from afar. Thou dost scrutinize my path and my lying down, and art intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, thou dost know it all. Thou hast enclosed me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. In the first six verses, we discover that God knows everything about me. God knows everything about me. That is a wonderful kind of knowledge. In the next six verses, we discover how the knowledge is related to God's presence. Where can I go from thy spirit? Or where can I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. Now you can think of the various possibilities of meaning of Sheol. It's a general word. And you can ask what meaning fits in this context of the possibilities of meaning. Is it the grave? Is it the pit? Is it the place of departed spirits in general? Or is it the place of evil departed spirits? You look at those possibilities and perhaps some others. If I take the wings of the dawn, very graphic, the wings of the dawn, If I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there thy hand will lead me, and thy right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, the NASB translates this next part, and the light around me will be night, as though this is still part of the expression of fear or apprehension or anxiety on the part of the psalmist. And then verse 12, even the darkness is not dark to thee, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to thee. The Authorized Version, I think, takes verse 11. Surely the, how does it read? Now, the interesting thing is that in the second set of six verses, there is an emphasis upon God's presence. Do you notice the question is raised, where can one go to get away from the presence of God? And the answer is nowhere. Wherever the psalmist thinks that he might get out of the presence of God, he discovers that God is already there. And you notice the emphasis is not upon simply God's knowledge being there, but God's presence. God is present. That is, he is there. Not simply his power, his exerted power, but God's presence. He is there. Doesn't say that God's knowledge or God's presence, no hint given, that that is what the psalmist is emphasizing. But God himself, God's presence. There is no place to which we can go and escape from God. Now, in one sense, that's a very comforting thought. In another sense, it's a very disconcerting thought. For one who's running away from God, that's a very disconcerting thought. Yet there's even comfort in the disconcerting aspect of it. For one who does not know God, I would think that that would be a very disconcerting thought indeed. Wherever a person flees to get away from God, God is already there. And he's there before the person gets there. Sometimes we have some peculiar ideas. You don't always know how those ideas started or how they developed. But some of our dear people conceive of God's presence as being in the church. You go to church to meet God, or to find God, or to be in God's presence. After the church service is ended and the janitor turns the lights out, God's presence sort of evaporates, and his presence is no longer there, or something in that order. And then there are certain kinds of places in which people would not be able to see or be consciously aware of God's presence. Certain kinds of environments and circumstances in which God is not viewed as being present. The point is also made as a distinction between, in the doctrine of the indwelling of the Spirit, between a believer and an unbeliever. And there are those who say, God is present in a believer, but he's not present in an unbeliever. And that's how they understand indwelling. Of course, all of that is purely spatial. Purely spatial. And if we take the implications of the doctrine of God's omnipresence, that God is present everywhere, and carry them out, we discover that God is present in the church when it's dark and when it's lit, and he's present in our homes, and he's present in the secret chambers, and he's present in prisons, and he's present in houses of prostitution, and he's present in Russia, and he's present in on Mars, and he's present in the unbeliever, and he's present everywhere. God's presence. But there you're talking about his, the infinity of his essence in relation to space. You're talking about a purely spatial concept. Now, you must therefore define whatever you do with the concept of God's presence that is as viewed in a different way. As, for instance, when the minister says, "We invoke thy presence," or the minister asks that the presence of God be manifested in the service, or when persons feel a peculiar sense of the presence of God with them, or in the case of the believer, what indwelling actually means. And that must be defined, but it may not be defined simply in spatial terms. Mr. Upton, accept that judgment. It is strange. Yeah. True, but strange. Part of the problem is, Mr. Hargrove, that we have been used to thinking about pantheism in a kind of an inaccurate way. If God is in everything, then God is in this lectern right here. This lectern. God is in this lectern. To say that God is in this lectern, some people would immediately say, that's pantheism. But that shows that they don't understand pantheism. Pantheism says God is the lectern. God is, it's an identification of God with the lectern. God is the lectern. See, pantheism would say, yes, God is in the lectern as far as location, okay? As far as location. But pantheism would also say God is of the same essence, the same stuff as the lectern, and pantheism would say God and the lectern are one and the same. There is an identity there. So, if we say everything is God, I am God, Mr. Perry is God, Mr. Hargrove, we're all God. That, you see, that's getting in the direction of pantheism, right? It may be polytheism, may have a pantheon of gods here, but it's going in the direction of pantheism because there's an identification of the creature with the creator. They're one and the same being. Okay, not just location. It doesn't tell you when you say God is in the lectern, that doesn't tell you whether you're talking about Christian theism or about pantheism. You've got to go further. You've got to say, well, is God the lectern? Theism says, no, of course not. There is a creator-creature distinction that must be maintained. And Christian theism would go further and say they're not even of the same essence. But in location, God occupies the same space as the lectern occupies. Now, I know that's a strange idea. That's why I said it's strange. I mentioned this before in another context, but I'll mention it again. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Roman Catholic, a French philosopher, anthropologist, held a view in which God and the lectern would be mystically related and would bear such a relationship that not only is God in the lectern, but there's a mystical union between God and the lectern, so that when I handle the lectern, I do it with a sense of awe and reverence, because in a very real sense, I'm handling God. Not that God and the lectern are one and the same, but God is mystically united to the lectern. Theism would rule out that view as well. Okay, that would be a different view altogether. Hodge mentions this in his discussion of omnipresence, that God is in every blade of grass, that God is in everything, but he is quite distinct from everything in which he is spatially present. And that's the idea in which I intend the statement, God is in the unbeliever, spatially. He occupies the space that the believer occupies. Now I realize that means that we're going to have to redefine what indwelling means. I understand that. Yeah. Mr. Moore, in my experience with the theological writings, I have not found many places in which the implications of the doctrine of omnipresence are consistently drawn. And therefore, a person who would not hold to some of those implications would not be heretical. The person simply would not have drawn those implications. That's all. Now, it's another thing if the person rejects the implications. Again, if he's consistent and works his way back, he'll have to reject the doctrine. Then he's heretical. Yeah. But a lot of people simply have not drawn the implications. That's all. And that's what theology is something about, Mr. Buzzard. Our spirit is somewhere. It has a location. We may not be able to posit it, but it has a location somewhere, whereas God is everywhere. The question that was raised a few minutes ago is given a finite space, if you adopted that cosmology, a finite space, is God as great as that finite space, or does he transcend it? And that's an interesting question. I would have to say God would transcend it. But if you hold to an infinite universe cosmologically, not infinite in time, but infinite in space. I realize that presents certain problems as soon as you say that, because if you make one coordinate infinite, then the question is, what do you do with the other? I realize that. But then I would have to say God is as infinite as space in an infinite universe. But I couldn't draw the analogy between the two because the soul is... I know the problem. Here's a person... We see this all the time. Here's a person who has an arm cut off or both arms. He becomes a quadriplegic, has no arms or legs because he had less spirit. Where is the spirit located? You keep cutting off things to try to locate the spirit. Try to make the spirit separate from the body. And then finally you come, is the spirit in the brain or is it in the physical muscle, the heart? As soon as you talk about the heart as a physical muscle, it doesn't sound as plausible as a location. If you talk about the heart in a different way, the seat of the emotions, then it sounds more like a possibility. But again, we don't know where to locate, as you said. We don't know where to locate it. We know it does have a specific location, however, coincides in general location with the location of the body in space. Mr. Perry.